to get the sound check.
Yeah, now I had a conference call scheduled for 3 o'clock.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Huh?
Okay, these usually go, yeah, we usually try and go for longer, so.
Longer than what?
They're usually, since they're oral history interviews, they're usually from 1 to 3 hours, so we try and schedule like
really?
A good, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I understand that we weren't prepared for that today, so that's, I
wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. Because we've had such scheduling snafus, that probably got lost in the mix, that piece. Well, let's see. So let's focus then.
Can it be continued or?
Yeah, we can definitely do that. So I guess I can start. This is for the Restoration Oral History Project. So this interview will go into the Restoration's archives and then also the archives at the Brooklyn Historical Society. Mm-hmm. And so we mainly want to focus on restoration, but as part of that, it's really great to hear from you, your personal connection with Bedford-Stuyvesant and all of that. So we don't want to stick within the bounds of restoration because so much of what you've done would relate, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll keep that in mind.
Okay. So I guess I will officially start the interview. My name is Sadie Sullivan. I'm with the Brooklyn Historical Society. Today is April 10th, and I am here in the office of Albert Vann. And if you would introduce yourself however you would like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my name is Albert Vann, currently a councilman for the 36th District, which encompasses Bedford-Stuyvesant, primarily Little Crown Heights. And that's who I am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you've been active in government for a long time. Tell me when you got started.
Yeah, I was elected first for the assembly in 1974. So the term began January 75, and I served in the New York State Assembly for 27 years. And then I was elected in the New York City Council, and I've been serving there for 6 years and 3 months.
Mm-hmm. And just by wonderful circumstance, I happened to meet with the person who was was he running that first campaign for assembly, Dr. Carlos Russell?
Yeah, I believe he was either the campaign manager or part of the campaign management that ran the first campaign, or the first campaign in 1974. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
He's a tremendous help to us, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. Maybe we can start in the present. What is your connection with restoration like today?
Mm-hmm. Well, currently they're in the district I represent, so I'm the elected official in the city council who try to respond to their needs and requests as relates to the city or as relates to the city council. And so we have obviously a very positive relationship, and I try to be as supportive as I can in trying to get capital dollars that they need or other types of resources from the state, from the city, I should say.
Mm-hmm. And how has your relationship as assembly member and council member, how has your relationship with restoration changed over the years as that organization has changed?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was a member of Bed-Stuy Restoration Board of Directors before I got elected. And once I got elected, I stayed on the board for a while, but eventually I came off. So I've always had a very strong interest in restoration's development, survival, progress, and have always been available to do whatever I could from whatever capacity that I could. In the early days, most of their money or resources or funding came from the federal government, as this was probably the first Community Development Corporation, first DEC, when they were established, and it was the pilot. It was the one to set the standard, if you will. And so a lot of resources came because they were starting out this new project. And so they didn't look at that time for a lot of local, quote, state or city support, because it's all come from the federal and other private philanthropy, private foundations, private money. And so I did, early on after I got elected, I know I started one fairly small project, youth workers project in restoration. And
you started that project?
Yeah, that mm-hmm. was with state funding.
Mm-hmm.
And we maintained it for a long time. And at one point, it moved from restoration to another organization. That was Fort Greene Senior Citizen Center. But I've always had to the extent they've expressed a need, or we perceived a need, and I was able to help to supply, respond to it. You know, that's been my role. I mean, I live in the community, so I utilize the services. I'm always involved in some aspect of restorations program. So it's very important to me personally and as the elected official for the area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about the Youth Workers Project?
No. Well, yes. I don't really recall a lot about other than it was a program that we got funded to work with young people, teenagers for the most part, you know, after school and weekends and so forth. It was cultural, it was recreational, it was academic, it was all those different aspects to it. It was what was needed at the time. And, you know, it was a helpful piece to add to the overall. You know, in those days, they had a lot of programs. They had regional centers. I must have had around four regional centers outside of the main building of the main complex of restoration. They had around the community, they had three or four different regional centers that we call, which was a way of both reaching out to the community and also soliciting concerns and needs from the community so that restoration could better serve, you know, their constituency. At some point, when funding began to dry up, and change in administration or whatever, and so funding was no longer as lucrative and available as they once were, they began to have to make cutbacks. So I think probably one of the first things that began to go were these regional centers. And at some point, then the restoration recognized that they could not solely rely on governmental, federal funding. And of course, they've always been supported by, you know, Ford Foundation and other foundations. It was a combination of partnership of government and private sector, if you will. You know, things ebb and flow. So at points when it was very tight to get money, they would have to adjust accordingly. And in recent years, I guess, when they began to fully to make a bigger demand on local government for support, because that was never their first interest or first inquiry. So that now they recognize that state and local government, along with their appeal to private and federal, is very, very important to their continued progress, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did it change the organization when the regional centers closed?
Well, that was symptomatic of a serious reduction in federal money coming to them. So it had a dramatic impact. You know, I was not on the board at that time, so I don't know all of the inner workings and so forth. But, you know, they had to withdraw a lot of their outreach activities and I'm sure they had to adjust their vision, and goal that they established, because they just didn't have that kind of resource anymore. And I'm sure at times it became very difficult to sustain the organization, and I would assume. And so all of the, you know, the list of executive directors that followed and boards, I guess they did as well as they could, and they did a good job in keeping it going. When the current president, Mr. Granum, came in, I know financially they were in probably pretty rough shape. He has been able to, I guess we can say, overcome at this point, pretty much. And now it looks good in terms of their future and the things that they're now doing. They're becoming very stable and remain to be seen in this community as the major institution that, you know, people can rely upon, as it, you know, really saved the blight that occurred in a lot of cities back in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s. It was really the Starship. And it never really lost that reputation, but I think it was probably tarnished somewhat by the lack of, you know, the cutbacks, so on and so forth. But now they're involved in a lot of the activities. They have, the city has recognized that this is a very vital organization to the community and to the city, and so there's a more favorable regard, which translates into more money and support for the institution and its programs. And so I think they're clearly back on the rise again to be a major support and transformative organization in the community.
Mm-hmm. And how has the people in the community, how have their connections and attitudes towards restoration changed over the years?
Well, I think they've always been a positive attitude towards restoration, again, because of the nature of the programs. They've all been quality types programs, and you know, in the arts, providing housing, providing employment, the basic things that a community needs. So they've always had, it's just a matter of how much they could provide, and therefore how many people would they touch, and so that would affect how widely the community would tend to, you know, rely upon and understand what they're doing and feel good about it. So they've always had, I can't say they've ever had a reputation that was not favorable, but it's just a matter of how many people they reach because of the nature and scope of the services they could provide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so were you involved when restoration and when the two corporations were first formed in 68?
Yeah, I was asked to serve on the first board of directors of Bed-Stuy Restoration, and as you indicate, there was a twin board, or the other board, the DNS Corporation. I forget the chairperson at that time, you may remember. And that was an interesting experiment. It was viewed differently by different people, but essentially, the perception was that the Restoration Board basically set the policy and represented the community's interests and priorities, and the DNS Board obviously had connections to help raise money and to serve as a sounding board or a guide and so forth. It actually worked well because you had quality people on both boards, and they were concerned about the success of the CDC of restoration to do well, and again, a lot of money was available in the early days, so it was about determining the best ways to spend it, or the most effectively way to spend it to get the best, you know, program that was conceived through Franklin Thomas and the board, Thomas Russell Jones being the first chair, and Franklin Thomas being the first president.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that there was I keep hearing snippets of it, but maybe you could tell me more that the community and the Central Brooklyn Coordinating Council had thought that there was going to be a different president, Donald Benjamin. Hmm. Do you remember that aspect?
Not really. I was involved myself in the community and other things. Basically, around that time, we had founded, I and others, I was a teacher, I started teaching 1959, I guess, in the community, and I'm from this community. Mm-hmm. And in 1964, some of us began to organize black teachers, or Negro teachers, as we were called in 1964, Negro Teachers Association. And so we were very involved in making parents aware of the fact that the school was not something apart from them, that their children were in the schools and they needed to come into the schools and get involved and so forth, and trying to make the system more responsive to the children, to the kids who were black and or Latino, and that the curricula needed to reflect that, the books needed to reflect that, the teachers thought it was a time in history when we were actually advocating for a lot of change to respond to. That was part of our civil rights movement, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so I was very, very much involved with others. And perhaps because of that involvement, I was among those asked to serve on Restoration's board. And of course, Franklin Thomas was a school friend. We both attended same high school together, and played varsity basketball together, Franklin K. Lane High School. So I knew him, he knew me, and he felt I could add something on the board. There was stuff going on with CBCC. I think they were responsible for Robert Kennedy coming into the community, as I try to remember. And L.C. Richardson could probably clarify that for you, because she was on CC, on the board of Central Book and Coordinating Council, as it were called, mm-hmm. Lucia Rose and others. So I'm just vaguely remember there's something going on, some struggle, tension, whatever. But I don't remember the facts of the situation, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was something going on before a Restoration became the vehicle that Javits and Robert Kennedy would use in New York.
Mm-hmm. What school were you teaching at in 64?
Junior High School 35, where I attended as a kid, and I'm very pleased to have come back and have my second teaching experience there. I taught in elementary school for a year, also in the community, before I transferred to a junior high school, where I felt I'd be a little bit more effective. And I was there for 7-8 years.
Mm-hmm. And what elementary school did you teach at?
PS 256, which is on Kosciuszko between Nostrand and Marcy. That was my first teaching experience. I was only there for a year. It was taught a fourth grade class. I think I did well, but I thought I was better suited for the older teenagers. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Mm. My sister's a junior high teacher in L.A. right now.
Oh, okay.
Yep, an age that she chose really specifically. There, you know, mm-hmm. The adolescent time's a hard time, but
oh yeah,
she's
it's a challenge. I'm
that's
sure
that's what I can do. So
yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I'm proud of her. Who were you working with on the Teachers Association?
We actually began in 1964. Most of the teachers who started it came out of Junior High School 35 and PS 21, which is a few blocks from 35 on Patchen Avenue. And Les Campbell, the names may not, well, people would know that. Dorothy Joseph, Marsha Goldman, Amos Jordan, Oliver's last name, something. There were a lot of us, names which I can't recall at the moment, who were part of the founding and the beginning of this organization, the Negro Teachers Association, which changed the name to African American Teachers Association after around probably 3 years, 4 years at the most. But again, our mission was to make the schools more responsive to and more reflective of the community. And we became citywide at some point. We did a lot of work, a lot of organizing, a lot of things outside of the school, workshops and housing authorities and churches, it really was a very, it was a mission-driven, a very, very committed to it, and we spent a lot of time and energy on the weekends and so forth to try and make it happen, quite successfully, I think. We did come into conflict and confrontation with the union, the UFT, because we differed on a number of major issues. So very often, when they would call strikes, we would organize to keep the schools open. We taught kids in the churches and so forth. So it became a rather ongoing struggle, so to speak, between the UFT and the African American Teachers Association, because their goals and objectives were not in the best interest, as we saw it, of poor kids, black kids. Mm-hmm. And so we did battle.
Mm-hmm. What were some of those issues
What comes to mind is there's a policy, well, the union shop, of course, we didn't go for that, that every teacher would necessarily have to take dues out, whether they wanted to join the union or not. Mm. That wasn't a major one, though, but that was one of it was the, what do they call it, something child. Anyway, the policy was that certain kids that acted out would be taken out of the class and out of the school and set up in separate schools. And that was a major policy that we disagreed with. We thought you work with those children and segregate them out and so forth. They didn't do enough, again, to try and bring black teachers into the system. There was very, very few black teachers, maybe one black principal in 1964. If there was more than one, it would have been one more.
Was it Adelaide Sanford?
No, she wasn't the first.
Okay.
No, she wasn't the first. I think it was a Mr. King, and he was at Pierce 70. He may have been the only one when we started, I may be in error there in terms of whether I know he was the first, and I'm assuming he was still around at that time, mm-hmm. or whether he had left prior to that 1964, I'm not sure. But very few, only one or two principals at most, very few black teachers around the system. And yet the schools were becoming more and more black and brown. And as I said, very few black teachers, which was part of our job. So the union, and I can understand it, we supported the organization in the early years under Albert Shanker, but there came a time when we disagreed with a lot of what they were doing, their policies. I'm trying to recall, I mentioned a couple of what they were, I'm sure there were many more. And so we became, I wouldn't say arch enemies, but we were in conflict with, in confrontation with a lot of the issues that they tried to bring about in the school system. Mm-hmm. That was just to say that I was busy. So I couldn't keep up with everything. I was also on the anti-poverty board, Bed-Stuy, what we call, whatever it was. And so, which Johnson started after Kennedy was killed. And Martin Luther King was struggling for the anti-poverty program, Bed-Stuy something. So I served on that board. I was active in community. So I guess it was sort of natural that they would reach out to me and people who represented the more militant aspect of community, because they had a cross-section. Most of the members, I'm sure, didn't have the same urgency that I and, let's say, Sonny Carson had. I think we were two that were probably be more reflective of the left side of things, mm-hmm. and to bring some kind of balance to the board so you didn't just have one view of the community on the board.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So going from there, tell me about, so you were raised in this community.
Yeah.
Tell me about from childhood till
well Yeah, born in Bed-Stuy and going to school, growing up here, not very far from where we are now, Herkimer Street between Schenectady and Utica. 635 is the first home that I knew in Bed-Stuy. I say that because I was born here and spent probably the first 3 years of my life here. Then I spent around 2 years, two or three years in North Carolina where my mother was from, and then was brought back to start first grade here. So I did spend, so my first recollection of life is in North Carolina, but my home is Brooklyn, and I grew up again from age six to current living here in Bed-Stuy.
And where are your parents from?
My mother's from North Carolina, father's from Virginia, and southern parentage.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of summers in the South as well. But it was, close-knit, very supportive community to grow up in Bed-Stuy. We all played together and went to school together. Everybody knew everybody. Parents knew all the children and looked out for them and supported them. We had a lot of activities after school, Boy Scouts, after school centers, all types of things going on. It was a poor community, and as we look back, our families didn't have a lot. My family was on home relief for a while. But that was the way it was, so it wasn't looked upon other than this is your daily life, this is what you do. We didn't feel necessarily deprived or thought that we were not less than anyone else. We just didn't have a lot of things, but no one did that we were aware of in our environment. So it was happy, if you will, wholesome development in our community because of the family unity in the community. Relations and support that was there. We'd go to we were all church-going people. Sundays, Saturdays or Sundays, if you kept the Sabbath, Saturday, Sunday, most of Christians. We'd go to Prospect Park on occasions as we got older. We ran a bike for whatever it was, an hour, because most of us couldn't afford bicycles. You'd rent. For hours, we'd ride out to Prospect Park. On occasion, we'd go to Coney Island. That was a big treat. Couldn't go every weekend, of course, but on occasions, we'd go out there two or three times during the summer, maybe. It was a fun place and a supportive place to live, Bed-Stuy. Fulton Street, between Utica and Schenectady and Troy, which is opposite the what is known as the Fulton Street Park, was an enclave of black businesses. All of the businesses doing that strip were owned by black people, which is astounding because all that is gone now, thanks to Model Cities, which was a program of New York City to do whatever is dead. I guess Robert Moses had something to do with that, but. The unintended consequence, I guess, was unintended. It wiped out a lot of economic development because we had a lot of businesses that were black-owned in that stretch when I was a kid.
And how did that happen? What happened that those business owners were pushed out?
City policy, eminent domain. Actually, that's where Boys and Girls High School is now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that strip there. And I'm up where we lived on Herkimer Street is also taken up by the Boys and Girls High School, at least the field, the whole complex. Two of the places where I lived was now taken up by Boys and Girls High School. And my mother also owned a business, a small grocery store. Eventually, she was able to acquire a small bodega, if you will, grocery store, on also where the school on Schenectady Avenue, which was eliminated due to eminent domain for the school. It was great early on. I was attracted to sports, to basketball in particular, so that became a very important activity for me. It sort of helped to direct the course of my life because of my active interest in sports and basketball in particular. And of course, friendships and relationships developed from that activity. Even today, there's always a camaraderie between guys who played ball through the years. And once a year, there's an event that most of them come to and renew the acquaintances and so on and so forth. It probably kept me out of trouble to some extent, to a great extent, because I had this positive activity that I was into. And the fact that my parents, my mother really raised us to try to make sure that we stayed on the right path, which was typical, again, of that time in our community. And most of my friends, everybody was, trying to do the right thing, working hard. We all went to work at a very early age because our families needed us to be, bring money into the household or at least support our own basic needs. So I would probably start working when about 10 or 11 on the weekends, either shining shoes or delivering groceries or whatever, collecting old newspapers because for the war effort, junk, whatever.
What would you do with the old newspapers?
You'd sell it. That would be recycled or whatever, go towards the war effort in World War II. I don't know what they did with the paper, but they needed it, mm-hmm. the newspapers to be brought back.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was recycled into whatever purposes. Yeah. But so much paper, you get paid for it, so much a pound or whatever the case mm-hmm. may be. So that was a way of doing something and making money. But shining shoes was the primary, that and delivering groceries was the primary. A lot I did as a teenager, young person, then eventually a teenager. And so the work effort, ethics, was very much a part of our time. Everyone was expected, did it, and it was not a big deal. It's what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And so. Mm-hmm.
And so tell me about the people who were... Oh, is it time?
My pardon?
Do you have to go?
Not yet, go ahead.
Okay. Where were most of the people in when you were growing up in the community, where were most of the people from? You said your parents had come from the South. I know that there was a big Caribbean community also.
You said it really. Either... mostly Southern and Caribbean, and whether it's Trinidad or as kids we didn't really get into where they were from. Well, you could tell somewhat by the accent, but it was never an issue. You might make fun of someone for a couple of weeks or so, and then they were into the family, so it was no longer a difference. And so there was no real differences based on the fact that one came from down south and one came from back home, if you will. It's all, became one community family, if you will, all with the same objective of trying to do well and do better.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we're just the tip of the iceberg, but I don't want to delay you from your 3:00.
Yeah, I'm gonna get on it right. Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought it was supposed to be an hour from 2 to 3, but that was my understanding from the schedule that the tail on the schedule.
Yeah, I probably didn't make it clear that that would be normal for a normal kind of interview, but these we like to.
Yeah.
Wander and get details. Can we set up another time?
Yeah.
Should I ask Sparkle?
We'll just set it up with you.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. I'm sorry we didn't have time to fully get into it, but got a good start.
Yep.
Okay.